This is Revolutionizing Recruitment with Kathleen Duffy, the art of attracting, acquiring, and retaining talent. Here's Kathleen.
My guest this week is Marcus Buckingham. Marcus is a global researcher and the world's authority on what the most effective leaders and highest performing people do differently. He's also the New York Times best-selling author of two of the most popular business books of all time. Marcus is currently the head of people and performance at the ADP Research Institute and is widely considered the world's leading expert on talent at work. Marcus, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So it's been nearly, 20 years, right, since your book, Now Discover Your Strengths, was written?
Yes, yeah. Well, actually, First Break All the Rules was first. So I guess that was 21 years ago. Yeah, it was First Break All the Rules. And then Now Discover Your Strengths was I guess, 2 years after that.
Okay, so you wrote it when you were 15, right?
12.
Yeah, there you go. But, you know, for me and other leaders, it really revolutionized how we perceive our inner strengths to lead and to inspire others to follow. And now here we are, many books later, and your latest book, Love and Work, was just released a few weeks ago. And I want to congratulate you on that. It's really an outstanding book. And
Thank you.
But the world has changed unexpectedly, and you have shared some of the unexpected changes that have happened in your life, your dad passing away and the end of your marriage, to which I'm sorry for both. But can you tell us how these unexpected changes in the world and in your life inspired you to start talking more about bringing love back to work and just bringing love back in general?
Yes. Well, I'm probably like so many other people. The last few years have been an opportunity to stop and look in the mirror and try to figure out what kind of mark you're wanting to leave on the world. And it's not that we all weren't leaving some sort of mark before, but the pandemic, although super challenging in many, many ways, did give us an opportunity to think about these sorts of things. And some days, I think for me, were quite dark, where you think, well, what am I doing with myself? And then some days were really bright, and you start thinking, well, I got to make sure that in the short time that we're all here, that I'm living a life that is a first-rate version of my own. And not that I wasn't doing that before, but the loss of my dad, the sale of my company, loss of my marriage, the sort of aloneness of the pandemic, it's a stimulus to go, all right, what's work for? And I'm not an anomaly. We see the great resignation, and it might be more the great reassessment, really, of when I go and spend 40, 50, 60 hours a week somewhere, what am I doing there? Am I just a cog in the machine? Am I invisible before I walk through the door of the office and I'm only visible when I'm in the office, and then when I leave, I vanish again? Or am I a whole human being? And I've got different domains in my life, and work is one of those domains, and I want to express myself in all of those domains. Is that really what my life is? It's not a balancing act of work versus life. It's just work is a part of life. Life is a whole bucket, and you're trying to fill it with energy, with nourishment, with love. And so that was, for me, an initial impetus to go, work has to be a place in which we get a great opportunity to express all that we are. Not the only place, but a wonderful place in which we get a chance to express all that we are. And yet so many jobs are loveless. We've designed a lot of loveless work. Well, frankly, we've designed a lot of loveless classrooms too. We've designed work as though love is not there in it. And then we're surprised when there's no love in it. So now you got a ton of people coming into the workplace again saying, I want a place that feels like it sees me and wants me to express all of me. You've got an unemployment rate of 3.5%, which is going to stay that way for quite a long time because of the demographics of our world. And so you've, as an employee, you've got a lot of power to say, I won't go work for a place that just sees me as a cog in the machine. I won't. I will seek out those places that are really interested in me as a unique human.
Well, it's true. And I, you know, one of the things I wanted to, I have many things to talk about today, but in the first chapter of the book, you kick it off by asking the question, how many years did you spend learning about you? And that I was like, whoa. And I was like the young lady in the book, Destiny, who hadn't really spent a lot of time thinking about themselves or how playing to my strengths was really going to determine my career path. And so kind of like you, you know, you were able to take this time and step back. And so after reading the book, I kind of did the same thing. And in my book, I share that my passion for recruiting started when I was a student at Arizona State University. And I was recruiting for my sorority, for Greek life in general, and I was a member of a group called the Devil's Advocates, which was the organization that would recruit top high school students to the university. And, you know, this is in the early 80s, and we really weren't talking about careers in recruiting in particular. And so I think that I'm one of the lucky ones who was able to find love in what I do every day. And I'm wondering, as you've went through this assessment, what are some of the things that you've discovered, some of the unique things that you discovered about yourself that you really love about the work that you do?
Well, yes, to begin with, it is interesting that I was talking to my my daughter, like most parents during the pandemic, at some point you became teacher parent as you sort of stepped in. And she was, and I put this in the book because it was so striking to me that she said, I think we were talking about geometry, and she asked me something about the difference between a parallelogram and a rhombus. And other than me not knowing or remembering what the difference was, it struck me that somebody had spent 10 years thinking about designing a curriculum to teach my daughter all of the different aspects of geometry. I mean, someone had really put in a shift to ensure that she and every other student knew all there was to know about geometry, different rules and formulae and languages and rituals about geometry. And that's great, because geometry is good, math is good. But there's no similar 10-year curriculum on her. She knows from very early ages that she's different than her brother, different than her cousins, different than the people she grew up closest to in terms of what she loves, what she's into, what she pays attention to, what bores her. And she knows so early that she's different, that she's not the same as everybody else. And so you'd have thought that all the way through middle school and high school, somebody would be putting together a curriculum to teach her some sort of self-mastery, as in, how do you use your regular life at school to see what you are drawn to see what you pay attention to see what you love, to see what you loathe? How do you use life to do that? And then how do you cultivate those loves into learning or into contribution or into joining a team, or how do you make decisions, or how do you bounce back when you don't get what you want? All sorts of things that you would imagine that the working world, once she graduated from college, the working world would want her to know all of those things. And yet when you look at that, you realize there's nothing. And so I'm sure you in recruiting, you know this, you have a lot of companies basically hiring people who have no fluency in their own loves, their own passions, their own nourishment, their own strengths. They're inarticulate, super inarticulate. And then the companies where they get hired try to sort of fix that and do remedial training on you. But it is a weird thing that we don't have any curriculum at all to help my daughter figure out how to talk about what makes her unique and distinct and how to contribute it, which is truly bizarre. For me, you know, one of the first things that if you wanted to say to somebody, well, what would you look for? Like, what would you teach a 9-year-old, if we go all the way back there, if you wanted to help them discover what was unique about them? If you wanted to help them have some self-mastery or self-agency in terms of who are you versus your gender or your race or your socioeconomic status or your nationality or your religion, or, I mean, all of those things are important sources of identity, but there's many millions of people that share all of those different sources. You are the only you there is. You're a category of one. So what sort of things could we teach you about yourself and your world to put some detail to that category of one, to who are you? And one of the first things you'd ask people to do is pay attention to what they pay attention to. Pay attention to their patterns of attention. What do you seem to pick up on that no one else does? What do you see around you that grabs your attention that might not grab anyone else's? Like, just start there. Start with what hits what's called your reticular activating center. Just what hits you. And with me, I remember like it was yesterday, I was 9 years old. I'm standing on a playing field watching a whole bunch of people participate in the high jump final of my school sports day. And as I'm watching them, I notice that the other boys with me that are watching, when somebody runs and tries to jump over the high jump, everybody watching lifts themselves up on their tiptoes or actually kicks their leg out as if they're kicking an invisible ball. And I've never seen that before. And so I'm like, that's weird. And I watch them again and somebody runs up, jumps over the high jump, and everybody watching does the same thing. They just lift themselves up or do something with their feet and something with their legs. And I remember asking everybody afterwards, why are you doing that? And then they're all denying it, asking the gym teacher why. And then she's like, I don't know what you're talking about. But I can remember to this day going, that's really weird. I'm paying attention to something real in the world that no one else seems to be paying attention to. And no one else is as geeked out about it as I am. And I didn't know that would lead to a career as a researcher. I mean, I'm nine. I had no idea that what that would lead to. And obviously no idea that 20 years later, a group of Italian scientists would discover the existence of mirror neurons that mean that we have instinctive empathy for what somebody else is trying to do. And that whenever you're watching someone do the high jump, you instinctively, you can't help yourself. You lift yourself up as though you're lifting up, will lift them up. Like, I didn't know any of that, but wow, wouldn't it have been great to help a nine-year-old like me find a way to capture that and go, well, that's interesting. That's a thing. That's not a thing. You're paying attention to something that's kind of interesting. Imagine every other kid doing that. And it's the smallest things. Which is why I started off the book by talking about this high school counselor who just starts his interviews with 4,000 odd kids with the question, you know, when was the last time a day flew by? When was the last time a day flew by? And of course, what a lovely question that is for any kid at any age, because they have all the right answers. And the moment you start talking about when did you vanish into what you're doing, or when did an hour just go by like it was 5 minutes, or indeed, when did you last notice something that somebody else didn't? Those sorts of questions are so brilliant because they're telling the nine-year-old, you know some stuff about you, and I'm going to help you figure it out. And then over the course of the next few years, I'm going to help you turn it into contribution, or turn it into learning, or turn it into you being a good student, whatever that is. We know some things about ourselves so early. And certainly for me, paying attention to people, for whatever reason, lifting their bodies up to get another jumper over the high jump was one of the first and earliest signs that I was paying attention to stuff that other people weren't, and it wasn't random.
Interesting. Well, so I hope that your daughter passed geometry.
I'm going to take a breath on that one.
Well, I do think it's interesting, you know, when we do think about our children, and I have a son and a daughter, and my daughter is younger than my son. And so when they went to the same high school, they expected to get, you know, Teresa to be very similar to Daniel. And they're two very, very different children. I'm hopeful that our educators are going to start to see the differences in individuals as leaders need to be. I love your question, when was the last time a day flew by? And get people to play in their zone.
Yeah, I wish I could be optimistic for you, but there will be some good teachers that your kids will bump into. How old are they, by the way?
Oh, they're old. As a matter of fact, today is my son's 30th birthday. So.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that's great. I mean, you hope as a parent, and to some extent, that's why I wrote the book too, because I look at my kids and I just hope that there's a world out there that does pay attention to their uniqueness. And yet, most of school and most of work isn't interested in uniqueness. It's actually interested in conformity, which is why most schooling is now really focused on information transfer and confirmation of that transfer through testing. And the uniqueness of your child is actually an impediment to that testing. How that child uniquely learns and how they uniquely make sense of things, how they are uniquely creative, all of that's just not relevant to you getting the right GPA so that you can get in the right college, where that approach to learning, that outside-in approach to learning continues. And then, of course, it continues on in the world of work, where most work we are measured against a standard list of attributes or competencies or skills or goals. And then we are told to basically try to fit the model. And success at work is mm-hmm. is often how closely do you fit the model, even if the model is tremendously well-intended and made up of lots of really good attributes like growth orientation or customer focus or executive presence or empathy. I mean, all jolly good things, but they were all defined and measured before you even joined the company. Somebody mm-hmm. has sort of decided this is what the job is, and then we're going to measure you against it and do a performance review against it. So who you are and what you uniquely love aren't just irrelevant to your performance at work. They're an impediment to your performance at work. And so you look at that at school and at work, this focus on conformity, and you suddenly start to understand why we have such levels of anxiety, why we have such levels of prescriptions of Adderall and Xanax and Wellbutrin and all sorts of things that are trying to basically drug down the fact that we don't help our students or our workers to stay connected to themselves as individuals. We don't. We distance mm-hmm. people from themselves. I mean, the correct psychological term is alienation. We alienate you from yourself. And then we wonder why only about 16% of us are fully engaged at work. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be that much of a surprise. I mean, the big fact of one of the reasons I wrote the book was to go, the really big question for your son and your daughter is, why am I different from my sibling? And if I wanted to be more like them, could I be? If I wanted to be less like them, could I be? Which parts of me are unique and enduring and that go with me from job to job, situation to situation? We know an awful lot now about the answer to that question. We know that by the time your kids were 19, they had 100 trillion synaptic connections in their brain. And what they loved and what they were into and what drew their attention, what captured their interest, what lifted them up was a function of those 100 trillion synaptic connections. And the differences between your son and daughter are a function of those unbelievably massive and complex connections or pattern of connections in their brain. No one will ever have their unique pattern again, ever. When they die, that uniqueness will never again be seen. It's like, what an amazing, beautiful thing a unique human is. And that, by the way, that doesn't mean you can't grow and learn. It's not a question of a growth mm-hmm. mindset versus a fixed mindset, because your son, obviously, he will grow. We know he grows more synaptic connections in his brain over the course of his life, but we also know that he grows more synaptic connections where he has the most pre-existing ones, which means his pattern doesn't vanish or turn into a totally different pattern. It means, hopefully, he becomes a more intelligent or more self-aware or less defensive version of himself, but he doesn't become someone else. And, mm-hmm. and yet for him, if you look at what we've taught him, where and how have we taught him to make sense of that uniqueness? In fact, we haven't taught him at all, but his life is actually showing him clues all the time as to what he loves and what he's into. And yet it's a strange thing. We don't really take his uniqueness seriously. We sort of cover it. And I think in the book, I was trying to say, that's not good enough, because we know that actually he'll be most productive and most creative when he is actually in his element, in his zone. So can we help him find ways to identify that which he loves, not for narcissistic reasons, but so that he can contribute all that he wants to contribute, which of course mm-hmm. is what he wants to do. It's what everyone wants to do.
Right, exactly. Well, and that kind of leads us into, you know, you talk about using the book Love and Work as a primer. And so I want to talk about a big workforce issue today, which is recruiting and retaining talent. And, you know, so if we're trying to get, you know, to pay attention to our own uniqueness, right? You know, right now the headset, and you work with so many organizations, I'd be interested to hear the perspective that you're, you know, hearing with your clients, but, you know, recruiters and hiring managers, they're really working to match a candidate with the skills and the experience that's on a job description. And so you have talked about people need to have the freedom to maneuver their job to fit themselves better. And that only, and I was really surprised to hear this, that only 18% of people say they're in positions that play to their strengths. So,
yeah.
You know, how are company leaders getting this?
I don't think so. I mean, that's why I wanted to publish this book with HBR, with Harvard, because I feel like when you first say the word love and work, it just feels a bit squishy, and leaders go, oh, come on. Are you saying people have to do what they love? And actually, there's no data saying that people, most successful people, do what they love. There's no data that says the most successful people love everything that they do. That's just, that's not real. But we do know from data that the most successful people say they find love in what they do, which is different. They find every day some activities that they love, and they're very serious about that. They take that very seriously. Not all day. Various Mayo Clinic pieces of research suggest 20%, it was that they're actually studying burnout in nurses and doctors. And it turns out that 20% of activities that they love is a really useful threshold. Doctors and nurses that say they find activities that they love to do for 20% of their activities or more are far less likely to burn out than if you get, once you get below 20%, 19, 18, 17, 16, there's like a, almost a perfect linear increase in burnout risk, almost like the numbers look fake. So when you get below 20% and you're getting days go by where you don't find any love in what you do, then you become depleted and you leave physically or psychologically. Although it's interesting, it is a threshold. So if you get 40% do what you love or 60% do what you love, it doesn't turn out that your resilience doubles or trebles. Mm-hmm. It is a threshold. So it's like you could have, I actually call them red threads, in the idea that your job, right, is made up of many different activities every day. It's not one activity. It's many, 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 many different activities. And there are many different threads, like a tapestry on a wall. It looks like a picture from far away, but when you get up close, there's lots of little threads. Well, that's what every day at work is like. Your job description might say salesperson, but you get up really close to it, and your day is just filled with thousands of different moments or activities or interactions. And these are all different threads. And some of them are white or black or gray or brown. They lift you up a little or down a little, but they don't really move the needle much. But some of them are red threads. Some of them are red. They are activities that before you do them, you look forward to them. Mm-hmm. While you're doing them, they just, you sort of vanish into doing them, and time does fly by. And they might last 15 minutes, but you felt you were doing it for 2 minutes, but boy, it just whipped by. Or when you're done with them, you feel some sort of sense of self-mastery that you felt in yourself when you were doing them. You didn't feel distanced or stilted. Well, there's red threads every day. And what we do know is that when you're doing an activity like that, when you're in that kind of red thread moment, your brain chemistry changes. And you have this cocktail in your brain. It's a combination of oxytocin and vasopressin, norepinephrine, dopamine, anandamide. There's like a cocktail, which, by the way, looks exactly the same as the cocktails when you're in love with someone. But that cocktail seems to dysregulate your neocortex, which makes you very focused and sort of outcome oriented. And it dysregulates that, and it leaves you open for more information and more creativity and more inputs, and you're just better. It's like you're on fire without the burnout. That's what that's like. So the feeling that we all want is that at work, not all the time, 20% of the time, and companies would get all the kind of creativity and resilience and engagement that they want. Are companies taking that seriously right now? No, I don't think they are. I think you're seeing a lot of companies basically pushing for a return to normal, as though we, the employee, as though we wanted a return to normal. But we really didn't. Even pre-pandemic, normal made us sick. Normal made us disengaged. With doctors and nurses, there was an epidemic of burnout in doctors and nurses pre-pandemic. And so we had a situation at work where across the board, work makes us anxious, work makes us stressed, work makes us disengaged. So now with 3.5% unemployment, those companies that are saying, okay, return to normal, what you love, what you're into, those moments of red threads, all that's rubbish. Just come back in, come back to the office and we're going to go back to normal. Those companies that say that, I think, are going to discover that they're out of touch with mm-hmm. the emotional state of play of the recruiting base, the labor force. Whereas those companies that say, we want to see you, we are really interested in you, we want to understand who you are and what you bring, we want to understand what you're into, we want to give you, it's interesting in the research that my institute, the ADP Research Institute, is doing, people don't really want flexibility of location, of where they work. They want flexibility of time. Mm-hmm. Because over the course of the pandemic, they got used to being masters of their own time, and they got pretty good at figuring out how to use their time intelligently. And now you come back to work and you're going to tell me you're going to now work in the office for 3 days, mm-hmm. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Okay, that's not great for me. Mm-hmm. Because I found self-agency during the pandemic. I kind of figured out how to get done what I needed to get done and yet still have all those other domains of responsibility in my life. Well, I want that to continue. I want to work for a company that says and follows through on the fact that they see me as a whole human and a unique human. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean I'm self-involved. It just means I've got some unique things about me that I'm proud of, or I'm wanting to get in touch with, or I want to contribute. And I don't want work to be a place that smothers that. Mm-hmm. So companies that get that sooner will win. And those that don't and play by the old rules, if you will, I think they're going to struggle to find the human capital that they need.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I wonder, I know you work with a lot of very large organizations. I'm a small company, and I've grown over the last few years. I have 50 employees now, and I feel like it's, and again, this is my prejudice, right? As a small organization, as the leader, I can bend and move, and you talk about the scavenger hunt of your career as opposed to a career ladder, and I love that visual, and I feel like in my small, nimble organization, I can allow my team to be on a scavenger hunt as opposed to a rigid career ladder. Again, are larger organizations, are you seeing that in some of these other places that they're getting the scavenger hunt piece too?
I would say not yet, or rather variably. As somebody once wrote, I can't remember who it was, Philip Dick maybe, the science fiction writer, the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed yet. So yes, there are some companies that are stepping into the idea that there shouldn't be rigid career paths. I mean, the public sector isn't one of them. So the federal government still has various, mm-hmm. actually by law, various levels that you climb up and that you have to manifest certain standard sets of skills or competencies in order to move up into those different rungs on the ladder. So there's huge variation around this. But the companies that have figured this out, actually, it's funny, they're focused mostly on teams. They've realized that the natural human condition for working isn't alone. Even though our human capital management systems tend to put people in as unique, sort of separated individuals, and their performance is rated as an individual. And very often we can't, inside these systems, we can't even see the teams. The best companies have realized, though, that we all work best when we're on a team. And the point of a team, I mean, it's interesting, the oldest, as I put in the book, it's like the oldest human art we've ever found is a 50,000-year-old mural on a cave in an island in Indonesia. And it's a group of individuals with sticks and arrows and spears. And they're clearly trying to capture or kill some animals. And what's interesting about the team members that are drawn is that they've got an animal characteristic. So one of them has the face of a lion, one of them has the trunk of an elephant, one of them has the tail of a crocodile. As if the artist was trying to represent the different strengths or loves or passions of each of those unique individuals. So one of them was as strong as an elephant, one of them perhaps was as wily as a crocodile. And so the earliest human art we've ever found is a picture of a team. And the point of a team, as you can see from this painting, isn't to tell people that they're not as important as the team, that there's, as we always say, there's no I in team. That's not the point of a team. Mm-hmm. The point of a team is to pull together unique individuals and have them achieve together something they couldn't do alone. So from a very, very early age, we figured out that human weirdness is not worth fighting against. Instead, you pull it together into a team, and then everybody's weirdness comes together in a way that's, in combination anyway, super useful. And the best companies are now focused more and more and more on what do our best teams do differently, because then we can be creative. It's almost like every big company is actually a little company, lots of little companies, lots of little teams. You have 50 people, but you've probably got 5 or 6 different teams within that group mm-hmm. of 50. Well, mm-hmm. so does Home Depot mm-hmm. or Walmart. You know, they're huge companies, but they've got lots and lots and lots of little teams. Well, if you have that, if you've got lots and lots of teams, then you can lean into the flexibility of allowing different people to find roles in different places and combine in different ways. Those places that don't understand teams really suffer. So the least engaged, least resilient two professions in this country are nurses and teachers mm-hmm. of all professions. And there's many reasons, perhaps, but one of them certainly is there's no teams in hospitals. There's very mm-hmm. few teams in schools. And then the nurse supervisor to nurse ratio in most hospitals is 1 to 60. So how can that poor nurse supervisor possibly do any of that creative role, you know, paying attention to each unique nurse and what he or she might love to do, where each nurse is a bit different and what they are driven by or how they contribute, a bit like that team of 50,000 years ago? How can you see the unique contribution of each particular nurse? If you got 60, well, you can't. So you don't. So the nurses burn out and leave. Mm-hmm. So wherever we see companies really interested in teams, we see all the good outcomes that you want. And whenever we see organizations which, for whatever reason, have diminished the importance of teams, you see all the negative outcomes. Mm-hmm. And I think following on from that, the more we lean into teams, the more we'll bring love, frankly, back into the workplace. And those companies will win if they do that.
Well, thank you for validating that. I'm having a very difficult time putting an organizational chart together because I really believe in that collaborative team environment, especially at my, you know, with my team, because certainly I know I'm doing an excellent job surrounding myself with people far smarter than I am.
Well done.
Well, Marcus, we have to stop here. But coming up in the second part of my conversation with Marcus Buckingham, the world's leading expert on talent at work, Marcus shares what companies have to do to stand out from the rest of the competition.
We'll treat you as a grown-up, and then we'll treat you as a unique person with unique loves and therefore unique dreams, and those will be interesting for us always. If you crafted messages around those two things, you would stand out, because most companies don't do that at all.
This has been Revolutionizing Recruitment with Kathleen Duffy. To connect with Kathleen or to learn more about recruitment research, go to duffygroup.com.